Please open your Bible to Isaiah chapter 28, verse number 14, where we want to finish our most recent look at some of the prophecies of Isaiah, the great prophet of the end of the 8th century BC. And Isaiah has a mixed message that he's passing on from God. There's a lot of stuff about judgment, particularly judgment that's coming through the Assyrians in the near future for the northern Israelis and other nations of the Middle East. But there's also judgment coming through the Babylonians eventually. And there's going to be exile take place. But there's also the ultimate judgment that's coming, the day of the Lord. And in the midst of all of this judgment talk, there is hope for a righteous remnant, for a group that will be resurrected out of death and transformed into eternal bodies, and they will live in the eternal kingdom that will stretch out from the ancient promised land well beyond its borders in a new heaven and new earth. And so all of that is just so intriguing to me to see woven together in the literature of the book of Isaiah. So in Isaiah chapter 28, verse number 14, God has just been talking about judgment and how the Israelis are going to have a timeout to teach them what they should have been learning all along. That is the basics of a relationship with God. And so he says this next, 28:14. Therefore, hear the word of he who is, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem. So he zeroes in particularly upon the southern kingdom and the leadership team that is there. Now, Ahaz was the worst of the kings of the later 8th century BC, that is the 700s BC. He seems to have even seized control from his good father, Jotham. But he doesn't seem to be able to stop his son, Hezekiah, from being a righteous man. So you've got this mixed bag in the leadership of both righteous and unrighteous. But in this case, God speaks against those that are playing around with eternal matters. Verse number 15, because you have said, we've made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have an agreement. And when the overwhelming whip passes through, it will not come to us, for we have made lies our refuge, and in falsehood we have taken shelter. Now, what seems to be intimated here, I think, is that the Ahaz government thinks that they are going to escape all of this judgment that's being talked about by the different prophets of this period in the form of the Assyrian invasion. Because Ahaz has reached out to Tiglath-Pileser III, the king, the emperor of this Neo-Assyrian empire. And he's paid him off to not take them into exile. So they've made a covenant with the death bringer. They've made a covenant with the whip that God is going to use against the rest of the nations. So they think they're going to get out of all this stuff. Well, what does God have to say to that? Verse 16, therefore thus says he who is God, behold, I am the one who has laid a foundation in Zion, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. Whoever believes will not be in haste. Now, that verse, or portions of that verse, are quoted by the Apostle Paul in Romans 9, and by the Apostle Peter in his first letter, chapter number 2. And they are in reference to Jesus being this precious cornerstone, this foundation stone, that if you put your trust in him, you won't be wasting that effort, and you will find it fruitful in the end. God says to these guys, what you really need, instead of putting your trust in Tiglath-Pileser, is you need to put your trust in me. I'm the solution to the problem. And of course, all of us understand that Jesus is the solution to all of the world's problems. Political solutions, financial solutions are never going to get rid of all these troubles that we live through. The real problem for this world is sin and all of the fallout from sin. Disease, death, disaster, and self-centered government. That will all be resolved when Jesus comes as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And so Isaiah, at God's directive, is trying to focus our attention back on the coming one, the coming king. And once he's in place, then right things will start happening. Verse number 17, I will make justice the line and righteousness the plumb line. And this is something we've seen, I think it was in Amos maybe. God uses descriptions of working construction tools. That is a line level, so you got a nice level to all your walls, but also a plumb line, so that you got a nice vertical line as well on those walls. So God says, I'm going to make justice and righteousness the things that the future kingdom will be based on. Hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and waters will overwhelm the shelter. So God will bring down all the other things that are in the way of establishing the eternal kingdom. Verse number 18, then your covenant with death will be annulled. Your agreement with Sheol will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, you will be beaten down by it. So God says, when I bring my judgment, it won't matter who you've made deals with. My judgment is going to be the thing that will happen. And so that's why you need to put your trust in me and not human kings. Verse number 19, as often as it passes through, it will take you. From morning by morning, it will pass through, by night and by night, and it will be a sheer terror to understand the message. Remember that the Assyrians are just the latest tool that God will be using to judge sin. After them, we're going to see the Babylonians. After them, we'll see the Greeks. After them, will be the Romans. And then we can go past biblical times and see other groups that have, because of the sins of the world, been allowed to run rampant. And the big thing is, in the midst of all of this judgment, people are supposed to be realizing, I need God. I need the one who really is fair. And Isaiah puts in here an interesting little simile, or a metaphor, or an illustration, that what it feels like to try to put your faith in someone other than God. Verse 20, for the bed is too short to stretch oneself on, the covering too narrow to wrap oneself in. So have you ever tried to get a good night's sleep on a too short bed? It's just very uncomfortable. Or have you ever tried to get a good night's sleep when you've only got a little tiny bit of fabric, not big enough to cover your whole body, but it's a cool night, and so you're trying to tuck it in on all sides and make yourself even smaller, and how uncomfortable that feels. That's what happens when you try to depend upon people to be your leaders to save you. What you really need is God. Verse 21, for he who is will rise up as on Mount Perazim, as in the valley of Gibeon, he will be roused to do his deed. Strange is his deed. This is a reference back to some supernatural events of the past where God stepped in and saved the day. And so Israel and Judah need to ask God for his assistance. Strange is his deed, and to work his work, alien is his work. That means it's outside of their understanding. Now, therefore, do not scoff, lest your bonds be made strong. For I have heard a decree of destruction from he who is God of the armies against the whole land. So Isaiah says, you need to quit making fun of this message and actually listen to it, which means you need to change the way you're acting. That's true repentance, because God's judgment is coming. Give ear, hear my voice. Give attention, hear my speech. Does he who plows for sowing plow continually? Does he continually open and harrow his ground? This is a rhetorical question. You know, when a person has a field that's intended to plant crops in it, does he just constantly, forever plow and harrow that ground? No. I mean, that would be worthless. He eventually has to plant the crop or he won't get a harvest. Well, in this case, it's the idea that you don't want God to continually have to judge you. You want to let him work you properly and then plant in you his seed so that it will grow. Verse 25, when he's leveled its surface, does he not scatter dill, sow cumin, put in wheat in rows, barley in its proper place, emmer as the border? For he is rightly instructed, his God teaches him. So just like the farmer eventually gets to the point where he can plant the seed for the harvest, God eventually in his judgment gets to the point where he can plant the seed for a later harvest of righteousness. If the soil will just behave itself. This reminds me so much of Jesus' parable of the four soils. You've got the hard-packed earth that you can't even get the seed into. And you've got the thin soil that doesn't provide any long-term growth. And you've got the weedy soil that chokes and makes unfruitful the seed. Those soils have to be worked over so that the seed can eventually find a good, fertile place to grow and produce a harvest. Our hearts are the soil that God's working with. Verse 27, dill is not threshed with a threshing sledge, nor is a cart wheel rolled over cumin. Dill's beaten with a stick and cumin with a rod. So the larger grain stalks have a threshing sledge pulled across them. But the smaller things like cumin and dill, you've got to have a lighter touch than that. Verse 28, does one crush grain for bread? No, he does not thresh it forever. When he drives his cartwheel over it with his horses, he does not crush it. So the idea here is, once the crop comes in and you're trying to get it prepared to be able to be used for consumption, you don't just keep beating it. You don't just keep threshing it. You eventually stop that and separate the wheat from the chaff so that you can then consume the wheat, use it. Well, God is not going to keep judging Northern Israel and Southern Judah and other nations. He will eventually get to the point where he can actually work with them to make something out of them useful. This also comes from He who is of the armies. He is wonderful in counsel and excellent in wisdom. So God eventually gets to the point where he knows he can get things done with these people, and then he can move on with them. At this point, we're going to leave the prophecies of Isaiah for a little bit of a historical interlude. I've told you several times, reminded you of it just a moment ago, that it appears as if Ahaz, the evil king of southern Judah, shoved his father Jotham, the good righteous man, off to the side, may have even locked him up, because it seems as if Jotham is still alive during the reign of Ahaz, that even though Jotham is supposed to be king officially for 16 years, we actually have a 20th year mentioned for him. So first, let's say goodbye to King Ahaz. Excuse me, King Jotham, who dies probably right around 731, maybe 730, somewhere in that neighborhood, and do a little quick summary of his reign. So 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 7. 27 verse 7, "Now the rest of the acts of Jotham, all his wars and his ways, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. Then Jotham slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place." Now, the next thing I want to talk about is how shortly before the death of Ahaz, it seems as if he declared that his son Hezekiah would be counted as the crown prince. Very common practice in different times, especially in unstable times, for a king to clearly designate who his heir is. So 2 Kings 18:1 tells us a little bit about Hezekiah. "In the third year of Hoshea, king, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign." Now that year, I believe, is indicated as 729 BC. And Ahaz was still reigning at that time. So that's why I think that Hezekiah begins to serve as crown prince just a couple of years before his father Ahaz dies. Might be related to the recent death of Jotham and the need to clarify the dynasty line of accession. Then we can come now to the death of the wicked king Ahaz. 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse number 26. "Now the rest of his acts," that is Ahaz's acts, "and all his ways from first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city, in Jerusalem, for they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of Israel. And Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place." So I believe this represents probably the fall, maybe the winter of 727 BC, when Ahaz dies, a young man still apparently, and he is such a rotten individual that they don't want to even put him in the royal tombs with David and the others. They bury him in Jerusalem, yes, but they refuse to put him in the royal tomb. Now, let's start talking about Hezekiah. Chapter 29, verse 1. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. So he is going to be around through the time of the Assyrian invasion of the Promised Land. He will be king when the northern kingdom goes into exile. Let's talk more about him. His mother's name was Abiyah, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the eyes of He Who Is, according to all that David his father had done. So that means that Hezekiah is a man after God's own heart. And along those lines, let's look at a parallel. 2 Kings 18:5. 2 Kings 18:5. And this is the overall assessment of King Hezekiah. He trusted in He Who Is, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. So this prophetic information lets us know that Hezekiah was the best of the Davidic kings. And that is why his kingdom becomes kind of a revival time for the people of southern Judah. Verse number 6. For he held fast to He Who Is. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that He Who Is commanded Moses. So Hezekiah is a godly man. He is a man of the book. He is a man of the covenant. Verse 7, and He Who Is was with him wherever he went out. He prospered. So God blesses him greatly during the last quarter of the 8th century BC. We'll come back and talk more about him later, but first, let's go back to Isaiah for a prophecy about what's going to happen to the Philistines during this upcoming period of the Assyrian invasion. And this is related at the beginning of Isaiah 14, verse 28, to a very specific event. In the year that King Ahaz died came this oracle. So we just talked about Ahaz dying and Hezekiah now being the sole king of southern Judah. So that's in 727 BC. Verse 29. Rejoice not, O Philistia, all of you, that the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root will come forth an adder, and its fruit will be a flying fiery serpent. Now this is probably a warning, poetic warning, to the Philistines. Don't get all excited that Ahaz is dead, because Ahaz had done some things against the Philistines. And they might be tempted to celebrate his death. But they're warned that there is something even bigger coming than what had been done to them under Ahaz. Verse 30, the firstborn of the poor will graze, and the needy lie down in safety. But I will kill your root with famine, and your remnant it will slay. So just a warning here that things are going to go badly in Philistia, even while they're going well in Judah. Wail, O gate, cry out, O city, melt in fear, O Philistia, all of you. For smoke comes out of the north, and there is no straggler in its ranks. That's a reference, I think, to the Assyrian invasion that's on its way. What will one answer the messengers of the nation? He Who Is has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. So Philistia is kind of used as a backdrop against which Isaiah can point out there's salvation only through the Lord who is being worshiped at Jerusalem. And that's where there's going to be refuge during this upcoming Assyrian invasion as part of God's judgment against the Middle East. Let's go to Psalm 83 now. Psalm 83, I think, probably pops in right around this time. O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace or be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. They say, come, let's wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they conspire with one accord against you that made the covenant. The tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, with the inhabitants of Tyre. Ashur has also joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot. Do to them as you did to Midian, as to Sisera and Yabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, all their princes like Zeb and Zalmanua, who said, let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God. Oh, my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind, as fire consumes the forest, as the flame sets the mountains ablaze, so may you pursue them with your tempest and terrify them with your hurricane. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O He who is. Let them be put to shame and dismayed forever. Let them perish in disgrace, that they may know that you alone, whose name is He who is, are the Most High over all the earth. So in all this Assyrian chaos, God is still the one that needs to be feared.